I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Frank Forensich. He's a biocentric guy trying to make a go of it in an anthropocentric culture. He studied human biology, martial art, and traveled to Africa to experience the human ancestral environment. He's the author of several books about health and the human predicament, including The Sapiens Curriculum and Beware False Tigers. So first, as always, thank you for your work in the world. And second, as always, thank you for being on the program.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you.
So we were going to talk about bioregionalism today. Do you want to start by sort of introducing the subject and then go from there?
Right. Well, I can remember being a child and sitting at the dinner table and listening to boring political conversations that my parents were having. But we had a map of California up on the wall in our kitchen. And I spent a lot of time looking at that map and looking at the lines on the map that appeared natural and other lines on the map that appeared artificial. And this got me thinking from a very early age about how we divide up the land. And it became clear to me that these straight line boundaries and borders just didn't make very much sense from even from a child's perspective of what you see on the ground. And so that led me to thinking about bioregionalism and where these straight lines happen to come from. So that's kind of the origin of my story with this.
So would you rather talk about where the straight lines come from or talk more about your story?
Well, yeah, let's talk about the straight lines, because I think that is that's a good place to start. It seems like such a violent thing to do to habitat, to take a ruler and draw a straight line. And this is something that is, I think, uniquely Western. It's uniquely modern that Native and Indigenous people did not do this. I think that their sense, they had a strong sense of continuity between their bodies and habitat, but then habitat also being continuous and having soft boundaries, you might say. And it wasn't until the scientific revolution where we started to work more with straight lines and lay down these boundaries that are artificial. So as to where it came from, I think a lot of it also goes back to our love affair with clocks that started probably in the 14th or 15th century. You start to get the advent of clocks, and geometry was a big influence going back to Euclid and Pythagoras. So this is how the modern mind works, and it's really dysfunctional when it comes to habitat.
Well, I'm thinking a couple of things. One of them is that the line, the map is not the territory, and how so often we end up believing that the map is actually more important than the territory. So I've got three things to say here. That's one of them. Second one is, I know that this has created some interesting situations along the Mississippi River over the last 150 years, because the Mississippi, I don't know if you've ever seen any of those maps that have historical, the flow of the Mississippi historically, where it writhes like a snake over the landscape, and mm-hmm. it'll go 20 miles east, and then a couple years later it'll flood and go 20 miles west. And so since the Mississippi was a state boundary, it would lead to awkward situations of all of a sudden you have 20 miles of Illinois that is in the next state over.
Right.
And then the third thing I want to mention, you can take any of these anywhere, is I lived for a while in North Idaho. And you'll note I said North Idaho and not Northern Idaho, because people in North Idaho are very – it's like North Carolina, South Carolina. They consider themselves separate from the rest of Idaho. They don't say Northern Idaho, and they capitalize the N. And the reason is that they think they should belong to a different – state that should be Western Montana, North Idaho, and Eastern Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes more sense to them, both politically and geographically. So I'm just throwing out all of these about the artificiality of many of these particular boundaries.
Right. And with the Mississippi River, Mark Twain used to joke about this all the time, because he had noticed the same thing, that the shape of the river was always changing, and you could have drastic differences as to where the channel would lie. And as a steamboat captain, that was a big thing for him. And so he pointed this out. That was the middle of the 19th century. And so anybody who studies biology, I think, is going to come to a similar conclusion. But yeah, here in Oregon, we have this push for a new state. I believe they want to call it the state of Jefferson, and that would be the Eastern Cascades. I don't believe that they talk about it as a bioregion, but I think inadvertently they're kind of making sense with it, because it is a very different place than the west side of the Cascades. And I think we need to start working from the facts that are on the ground.
So let's move to your what are you doing about bioregionalism these days?
Well, I've got this sort of highly ambitious plan and a website that I'm working on. And I've got a domain that is called life.earth. And my idea for this is to have a website that has a map, a bioregional map of the world. And it would be similar in some respects to Wikipedia. So you could mouse over any of the bioregions that you see on that map, and it would give you the name of the bioregion. For example, if you were to mouse over the Pacific Northwest, you might see a label that says Cascadia, and then you could click on it and it would give you a template with all the human and non-human activity in that bioregion. And just like Wikipedia, we could get people to fill out these templates. And after a while, it would become a system in its own right that it would be a workaround, basically, work around traditional conventional boundaries and give these bioregions more autonomy and more functionality than they have right now. So that's the overview of this. And I have some ideas about the technicalities of making it work, but it's a way to do everything differently and put people back in contact with habitat.
So would this, you go to Cascadia, and then do you, how, I presume that it scales down. Mm-hmm. And so you can go to I'm running into trouble already because I am also part of the region that would consider itself part of Jefferson, the state of Jefferson. Because it ends up that there's a couple counties in Northern California, Shasta and Del Norte, and then what's the county just across the border, Josephine? And we don't want to get too much into this because people are listening who aren't local. But anyway, so let's drop that and go back to Cascadia. Can you then center in on smaller areas
within that? I suppose you could. It depends how much work you'd want to put into the project. But I think the key element here is to gather a group of bioregional experts. And there are people who do this, who draw these maps and take measurements of plants and water and animals on the ground to define these bioregions. And then you have to collect that data and put it into a database that will draw the map. And if you can do that with any kind of accuracy, then it becomes usable.
Yeah. I love this. And I'm thinking about, I'm thinking a couple disparate conversations I had. One was a conversation with a marijuana grower from Santa Cruz who said that one of the problems with legalization has been that they're now allowed to grow in particular parts of valleys. But before, with everybody having these tiny little grows, they had really specialized in the strains because of the fog causing mold. And so you would have a strain that would be really highly localized to your particular part of a particular valley. And then the other thing I'm thinking is I was talking years ago to this guy who absolutely loves prairies and was doing tremendous prairie restoration work. And he was a bit more so I'm very concerned about making sure that natives are the ones who are reintroduced, you know, native species, native to that place. But he took this to an extent that I thought was quite extraordinary, that he didn't even want plants of the same species that were taken from, say, 50 miles away, because he said they didn't evolve in that particular slough. And I know I'm getting a bit off track here, but I just think it's so fascinating to think about how, I mean, there's a bioregion of the Cascadia, I'm gonna give a better example. I live in Crescent City, and it's redwood forest here. You go 10 miles east, and it's ponderosa pine forest, because there's a little mountain ridge that creates. It's always foggy here. You go 10 miles east, it's 20 degrees, 30 degrees warmer, and it's also a lot drier. So I would love to see what you're doing. And I hate the way most people use the word fractal, and I'm going to use it the same way most people do here. I would love to see this applied, you know, down to a smaller scale. So you have first the Cascadia region, but okay, well, why don't I back up? Why don't you tell everybody who's listening, because they might not live in this region, where does Cascadia start and end, more or less?
Oh, well, see, I'm not the expert on that. I would take a wild guess, and I would say that Cascadia would include Seattle and Bellingham and Vancouver, for example. There's similar weather, similar flora and fauna in that region. So you'd have to start big, and you would isolate the biggest bioregions that you could. And then once the system's in place, then you could make it, you could fine tune it from there. But and I'm sure there's disagreement even amongst bioregional experts as to where you would put the lines. But I think you could solve some of this by having liminal zones, transition zones between bioregions that could have their own pages, their own descriptions, their own templates, if you will.
Which is how nature works. I mean, you've got the stream, and then you've got the riparian zone, and then you have, it's not like you have a riparian zone that goes for exactly 50 meters and then 51 meters you're in the interior of a forest. It's more of a gradual change.
Yes, and that would be the technical challenge in all of this, is taking the facts on the ground, the data that's gathered on the ground, and somehow crunching that and to make the map. And if you could do that, but you'd have to update it frequently, because with climate change and everything else, you're going to have changes in those boundaries. But I think it's a doable thing.
And so is it time yet to move to what are the sort of implications of what you would hope to accomplish, and what are the both, I don't want to say just political, so what are the implications overall of a project like this, and what are the implications of beginning to – okay, it seems to me that part of the point of this is to help people to begin to think bioregionally. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so what does that look like to think bioregionally, and what does that – what are the implications of thinking bioregionally?
Well, I think the early adopters would be scientists. For example, in Cascadia, you have the line between the U.S. and Canada, and you have cross-border collaborations that are going on now with air pollution and water and the whole thing. And this bioregional model would make it easier to do these so-called cross-border collaborations. And that would be, I think, some of the early adopters. But then you would also see cultural shifts too, and it would be an opportunity for people to talk about bioregional foods and bioregional art and bioregional even medicine, bioregional athletics, all of these. In fact, that's where I kind of got started with this, because I look at athletic activity around the globe now, and it strikes me as absurd that people get on jet airplanes to fly around the world to train and to play a sport that they could play at home. So bioregional athletics would be an excellent starting point to get people involved in this.
I think that's great. And I'm thinking also of some specific examples from when I lived in North Idaho of this cross border. Selkirk caribou are now extinct in the United States, and there are still some up in Canada, but they that was the caribou did not respect the border, believe it or not. And that was always part of the I don't want to say problem, but that was always part of the that was part of the equation that people had to look into when you're discussing attempting to save the Selkirk caribou.
Mm-hmm.
And so go ahead.
Oh, well, it's almost funny because none of these non-human creatures respect our borders. And it's everything from pollinators up to, mammals and fish and everybody. I mean, our borders are kind of a farce in a way. So this would move us closer to biological reality, which is something that we're going to have to do no matter what, because as these long distance supply chains and transportation chains begin to collapse, we're going to be forced to take bioregional or local perspectives no matter what. So why not have a system in place to encourage that?
Well, this is one of the things you and I have not talked about, but I have talked about a little bit, that is, I got really interested in the whole COVID thing about 2 weeks in, when a Hyundai factory in Korea shut down within 10 days to 2 weeks of the city of Wuhan shutting down. And that struck me as extraordinarily fast, that a factory, I don't know how many miles away, let's call it 1,500 miles away, is forced to shut down because some city shut down. And then the implications of that, I think, are huge, that you would think, even if you don't care about the environment, and even if you don't care about, and even if you care primarily about nation states as such, you would think that having such a globally interdependent economy would make one not able to sleep at night, because it can be interdicted at any point. And it's crazy. You have chickens grown in Arkansas that are then killed and processed in China, and mm-hmm. then it's mm-hmm. just that sort of. And there's a difference between relying on a factory in a different country for a computer part, or for some part for a computer game. I mean, something that doesn't, but when you get to food, you would think that we would learn the lesson and relocalize, but I don't really see us as having done that much.
No, because it's always about the money. Where can you get a cheaper processing plant, or get a more efficient supply chain, and that sort of thing. And so we're really asking the wrong questions, but, the collapse of these big systems is imminent, and we don't have a plan B. And this, I think, is something that could function that way, especially when we get some early adopters, people clicking on the map and say, oh, what's my bioregion called, and what's going on in my bioregion? And it would take a few thousand people to get started, but I think it would gather some momentum. And I think Cascadia would be an excellent first go at this. We write a page for Cascadia talking about the plants and the animals, and then the human activity, everything from arts and culture to commerce and food, of course, water, of course, and get that one up and running, and then use that as a model for the other ones.
So what would I want to go back to relocalizing the food systems. What would that apart from the obvious of, local ranchers or local farmers, what would that look like to begin to relocalize? And what would that look like on a sort of larger scale too? How would you envision that happening?
Well, I think what this project would do would, there's a way you could do it to incentivize people to take local perspectives. So you've got the page for your bioregion, and sure enough, you look there and, oh, here's a brewery, or here's a here's a restaurant that's local, and we give them attention. We give them a listing on a registry, for example, that will highlight their work that's relevant to the bioregion. So now all of a sudden they get to advertise, I suppose, and get more attention to what they're doing in that bioregion. And we grow and give preferential treatment to anybody who's doing local work. And then they're going to, their star is going to rise and they're going to become more profitable.
So what's the next step for this actual project of yours? Do you, you know, you've talked about Cascadia a lot, but are you thinking of how do you develop sort of that team of people who would do the same thing for various bioregions in, I don't know, India, Laos?
It's a question of getting the thing started and getting some early adopters on board. Obviously, it's going to take a lot of money because you need to hire bioregional consultants and especially good computer people who can build the database and make the map accurate and set up the templates for each bioregion. But then you just go, I think you start with scientists and biologists who would be most likely to populate those pages early on and to get things rolling. And then I think the media would be onto it because it's new, it's different, it's a completely different idea. And even getting a little bit of media attention, you'd have more people clicking on their bioregion to see what's happening there.
So let's talk a little bit more about your particular bioregion. What, because you've talked about Cascadia, but what is the bioregion for Bend?
Well, Bend would be a little bit, Bend is funny because it's kind of a liminal zone. It's kind of a transitional area between high desert and sort of sage alpine, you might say. And so this would be a border. And if you're talking about west side of Bend, that's going to be more alpine. If you're talking about the east side, that's definitely going to be just straight out high desert. So all of eastern Oregon pretty much is going to be that high desert until you get to Bend, and that's the transition area.
And I think the thing that interests me most about all this is how do we get people to even think about themselves as a member of a local habitat, and how do we get just yesterday I had an interaction with somebody from some tiny town in Mississippi. And if I were to live 100 lifetimes, I think I would want to live one or two of them in the deep south, just because I love the green and I love the insects and mm-hmm. I love that. You know, I've never lived where it's that hot, but when I have been in places that are that hot, it's kind of fun for a while. And so anyway, and also I've heard that the I want to do an interview sometime about the destruction of the Great Delta Forest in Mississippi. I find those areas really magnificent. But honestly, when we think of most of us, I don't think most of the time think of ourselves as living in a region. We think of ourselves as living in a city or state. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm trying to get at?
Right. Well, we've been conditioned to think that way. And let me back up. I actually pitched this project to a venture capitalist in Seattle. And he looked at my map and he listened to my pitch and he said, well, people just don't think that way. And I was a little bit put off by that. I was like, well, I think that way. All my friends think this way. But it's also the case that Native people and Indigenous people think this way. And there's enough Native and Indigenous people around the world who would start with this, who would say, yeah, that's a good approach. And we understand what that is. And we think this way and we'll start using it. And so even if it's a small number, it's enough to seed the project. And of course, we have to change culture. I mean, but when this great unraveling comes to pass, which is going to be soon, people are going to run out of options. People are going to say, we got to have something. And conventional government, conventional culture is not going to be able to fill the gap. So maybe they'll go for this.
So, you know, you've mentioned this a few times about the sort of great unraveling. And I think a lot of people who read my work and a lot of people who read your work will know what this is about. But can you be a bit more explicit for people who and one of the things I talk about is that if I were to sum up all of my work in one or two sentences, it would be, this way of living won't last, and when it's done, I would rather there be more of the natural world left rather than less.
Right.
And so,
well,
justify for those that this way of living won't last. I mean, because you're talking about unraveling.
Right. And systemic collapse is imminent now. People talk about climate, and of course, there's plenty of evidence to show that that is now reaching catastrophic levels, and the tipping points, especially Arctic methane, permafrost, that whole thing. It's a nonlinear process by which that simply means that there's acceleration involved. And so this is going to become really bad, really fast. But that's only part of it. The biodiversity crisis. There was a piece, I think, in The Guardian just today about the demise of vast areas of plankton in the North Atlantic. I mean, we are tearing the fabric of the natural world, and it's inevitable that we're going to have large areas of habitat that become dysfunctional, uninhabitable. This is going to happen relatively soon. So that's what I mean by this imminent collapse.
I know this is a bit off of our remit, but presuming that many people will, I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. My concern is that I think the denial. How do we get through people's? How do we get people to remember that there is a territory? I mean, I know that this is what you've been saying this entire interview, and I'm sorry that I keep repeating myself, but you know, the training that the map is more important than the territory is so ingrained at this point. And how do we work toward undoing it? I know, and again, I mean, you're probably thinking, geez, Derek, you know, I've been telling you for the last 40 minutes how we do it.
Well, it always gets back to culture, and that means we need leadership, and we need people in positions of prominence, people with megaphones, to be talking about how this is important. And by and large, we're not hearing that from our leaders. You rarely, if ever, hear a political leader talk about the nature of the plants and animals in their region. It's got to start somewhere. So this is, I think, activists who are working on political issues or policy issues also need to take this up and need to start talking about a bioregional focus and how important that is. But it's definitely an uphill battle. I mean, we have to change the minds of billions of people, you might say.
You know, one of the things is, before we turned on the recorder, we had discussed the possibility of doing an interview, not about this subject, but about the importance of stories. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the two interviews are actually coming together now. Can you talk for a minute about the importance of stories and the stories that were being told that are, again, the sort of anti-bioregional stories, and tell us more of the stories that we should be substituting?
Right. Well, the original story for Native Indigenous people was built around continuity between the body and habitat. So, and this is why wherever you go in the world, you hear Native people saying things like, I am the land is me. I am the river is me. I am the forest is me. And that is historically normal. That is the way historically normal people speak about their relationship to the land. And it's only in the last few hundred years that we've been able to divorce ourselves and come up with this new story that we are somehow these standalone independent organisms. And a lot of that has come from industrial agriculture, because when you buy food with just a swipe of a credit card, you have no relationship with the land. Your food just comes packaged and it's there it is. It has no relationship to anything. So that story of human exceptionalism and independence has come to dominate the modern world, but it, historically speaking, it's an abnormal story. And so somehow we need to get more, you might say, Native storytelling back in the mix.
So what does it feel like to I was just right before we did the interview, I was walking around outside and I saw a slug eating some vulture poop, and I just was looking at trees and I saw a tree that probably 7 or 8 years ago was broken by a bear, a young tree, and it's still coming up and spreading. You know, instead of the main trunk coming up, now all the other side branches are coming up. And what does it feel like, and how does one begin to remember that one is part of, how does one begin to fall in love with the land?
Well, I go back, personally speaking, I go back to experience I had in the Sierra Nevada mountains our family used to go camp in, and I must have been 6 years old, and I remember climbing around on the boulders by the river and thinking that was the best thing ever. These clean granite boulders, they had just the right texture, just the right friction for my hands and feet. And I had a really powerful experience at that moment. It felt like the world was made for me, or I was made for the world. And if somebody had said to me at that moment that all these animals and plants are your kin, I would have accepted that as reality. I would have said, yes, of course, I can feel that. And it was only much later that I began to feel the alienation. So I think it's partly early experience, it's partly culture, but it's especially time in nature. I mean, you have to do the time on task, you might say, and spend that time to immerse yourself and to reestablish your identity with the land. That's what it all comes down to. Experience is great, but you have to make that leap to identification. And once you do that, your whole world changes. For me, it's changed in pretty powerful ways, because I feel more connected, but I also feel more angry and more wounded by seeing the trauma that we've done to the natural world. So I think that's one thing that keeps people out of that loop.
Well, a couple things. One is that years and years and years ago, decades ago now, I interviewed Vine Deloria, and he said that a lot of his students would go at the university, would go hiking, and then they would come back and say, oh, I had this great nature experience, and now I feel bonded with nature. And he would say, no, you had an aesthetic experience. It was beautiful, but that's not the same thing as like living in a family and knowing, you know, that your uncle, you know, oh, it's a simple little example. Every time after dinner for the next hour and a half, my grandmother would always have these tiny burps. You know, it's like just knowing, which you wouldn't know unless you, you know, spent extensive time with my grandmother. And it's we all have. And the way you get to know those things, and this is true with a lover, it's true with a friend, it's true with the land, is just not one date, but instead, you know, extensive time over a long period. That's one thing I wanted to say. And the other is there's the famous Aldo Leopold line about how, you know, if you're ecologically aware, and, you know, God knows things are a lot worse now than they were then you're basically living in a world of wounds.
Right, right. That's totally true. And I think that's why people persist in their denial, because it hurts too much to really look at what's going on. But getting back to nature as an aesthetic experience, to put it another way, we could say that nature has become just another form of entertainment for people. And that this is the whole second half of the 20th century, with the advent of television, more and more things got pulled into this domain of entertainment. And it started with just people and sitcoms and that kind of thing. But then food became recreation. Food became a form of entertainment. And then nature became a form of entertainment as well. And people go outdoors, but they have their phone and they're taking videos. And so nature is also a form of entertainment now, which is, it is crazy. I mean, this is our life support system, and it's far more substantial than just a pretty calendar on the wall.
And also more substantial than an amusement park.
Yes.
It's, you know, I when I was a teenager, I did my share of inner tubing in mountain streams, and I have friends who've done a lot of very tough mountaineering, and I recognize the both art and athleticism of that. But even my friends who have done a lot of rock climbing have said that they have criticized some climbers for basically taking either a conquering attitude or an amusement park attitude, as opposed to I'm guessing what you would say would be more of a martial art attitude. Can I say that?
Sure. and I agree totally, because what I've seen in the world of rock climbing, especially over the last 20 years, is this really powerful emphasis on speed and setting records. And that is not the way a historically normal indigenous person would relate to habitat. It is a conquering attitude, and it's a self-glorifying narcissistic attitude as well. So that is not the way. I think the adventure sport community is impressive, but I think they're missing the point here. This is something I think that older athletes learn, is that you get older, you get injured, you have to slow down. And now all of a sudden, the world looks different. And all that habitat that you went marching through or speeding through now starts to look a lot more nuanced and a lot more beautiful than it did before.
So years and years ago, I knew this woman who would enjoyed running. And she would, like, every day run 15 miles or however far they run. And this was back in the early days of the Walkman. And we were having a discussion about Walkman one day. And I said something about, yeah, I can see why a person would put on a Walkman when you're running, because that's so boring. And oh my, she, the look she gave me was, I don't know if it was more amused or disgusted, but she's like, no, when I'm running, one of the things I love doing is listening to all the sounds of nature. I mean, that's half of the joy of running for me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously I'm not a runner, and that I had completely missed the point, but she was making the point of that was a way of, she wasn't like doing it as a task. I need to run 15 miles, so I need to listen to something to make this time move more quickly. Instead, that was all part of her immersion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I lived in Seattle, there was a nearby trail called Mount Si, and it's the closest big trail you can get to, and it's like 4 miles of uphill, and the parking lot is immense. I mean, you on a weekend you'll see 200-300 cars there, and lots of people going up and down the trail, and it was always amazing to me to listen to the conversations that you would hear. A lot of people talking about work. A lot of people, Seattle, big technology town. A lot of people talking technology and websites and all this stuff. And I realized they're just maybe getting a little cardio activity, but there's no nature contact here really at all. So it depends how you do it.
Oh, gosh, that reminds me of one more thing. And then we'll come back to your project. I remember 20 years ago being in Seattle and I'm no better than anybody else because I was stuck on a highway and I'm in a traffic jam and I look up and I see there's this huge, beautiful window with a beautiful scene off to my left. It's on my right. Off to the left was it Lake Union or something? Some pretty lake. Mm-hmm. And there's all these people lined up on treadmills inside the window.
Yeah.
Walking. And I it's nice that they're able to look at it, but still there's this. And of course, again, I'm no better than they were because I'm sitting here, I'm laughing at them as I'm sitting in a traffic jam in a car.
Right.
In one of the most beautiful places in the world.
Yeah, I had a similar experience in Hawaii, actually, walking down the beach in Hawaii. And there's a big luxury hotel with the gymnasium on the ground floor with big windows all around. You can see all the people in the gym on the treadmills when they could just be like on the beach. It was pretty funny.
On the real beach.
Yeah.
Well, OK, so that is such a nice segue to take us back. I would like for you to talk again just about I love this last, 10 minutes or so where we've been. I think it's stories is how we reconnect to stories and experience itself is how we reconnect to the place. So can you bring us back to the importance of bioregionalism, both from a ecological and given the imminent collapse of society, the practical level, and then take us back to your project and conclude there?
Okay, well, I think I would start with one of my journeys to Africa and looking at the habitat. This was especially true in Botswana and South Africa, where you go out on the Kalahari Desert and it's vast and you're up in a light airplane and you can see all the way to the horizon and there's no mountains. There's nothing in the way of landmarks and it's hard to even believe that people live down there, but they do. And then you start putting it together, you realize that the way they navigate and the way they map their bioregion is with culture and with ritual and with story. And they go out on a hunt and they have an emotional experience at a particular place, whether it's seeing an animal or doing a kill or maybe finding water, whatever it is. They sing a particular song. The song is meant to be sung in that place. A story is meant to be told in that place. And so little by little over generations, you build up this culture that's totally woven into habitat. And that's the task ahead of us. To do that, but it's such a big ask. It's such a heavy lift right now because we're not accustomed to doing that. Culture has now become entertainment. And so we have lost our ability to connect our stories to the ground. And this is why we need people who are out there, whether it's farmers, hunters, mountain guides, anybody who's in daily contact with the ground to be speaking up and talking about this. And this is where I think the activist needs to do a little bit more work because we're so busy fighting the big battles in government and in corporate power structures. But we need to be talking about the earth too.
You know, this reminds me of something I used to say all the time in my talks, which is one of the reasons that most of us don't defend the places we live is because we don't actually live there.
Yeah.
And I used to like name a couple, three celebrities. And then, I mean, at the time it was, Brad Pitt Angelina Jolie. I don't know who it would be today, but it's the same equivalent. Like if I say the word Brad Pitt, you probably form a picture in your head. And I would just be rambling off some inane trivia about them. And then I would stop in mid-sentence and I would say, okay, how many of you can name 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of your home?
Nobody can do it.
Yeah. Well, I can't do it. You know, I'm no better than anybody else. I'm like, okay, there's blackberries, there's huckleberries, there's blackberries, and there's huckleberries. It's like, and I'm stuck, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think, yeah, so that's just such a great example of us not living where we live.
Right. Yeah. Adbusters magazine put together a piece where they showed the corporate logos alongside plants of your native bioregion. And, you know, the message was obvious that, you know, most people could name the corporate logos, but nobody could name the plants and animals. So it's a big lift right now. And I think any transformation here is going to be driven by desperation and necessity. I mean, if you don't have the trucks coming in, bringing your food into your grocery store, you're going to have to go elsewhere. And people are going to have to start looking, you know, in their neighborhoods as best they can.
Yeah. So let's two things. One is talk for just a moment about this project again, and then end with how can people find out more about your work?
Right. Well, the project, if you just go to life.earth, you can see the basic roughed in idea there. And it's only just a 4-page website. There's really not that much. So to make this work, I would need backing. I would need a team. I would need experts and consultants to make it all work. But in the scheme of startup companies, I guess, it's really not that big a deal. It could very much be done. I did some research looking at various universities that have bioregional departments and that kind of thing. People are out there that would work on this. So if we could assemble a team and have some kind of a budget, it could happen. And I'm willing to put a bunch of work into it. But, you know, for the time being, it's just an idea.
And then how do they find out more about your work in general?
Oh, well, you could go to exuberantanimal.com. That's everything's there. And you can go to life.earth, and that's the bioregional look. And that's what I've got.
Well, thank you so much for all this. And thank you, as always, for your great work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Frank Forensich. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.